The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. It's always great to get some feedback, like I did yesterday, spending some time over in the Netherlands with some of our most faithful listeners. I comment to them frequently that I visit that area a little more often than some of the other areas that are out there listening in on KPCG. But there's a handful of them down there that really do listen religiously, you could say, every afternoon. A lot of them live, 2 p.m. in the afternoon, Netherlands time. 1 p.m., of course, it plays here in the U.K. So it's great getting some of that feedback. It was a short trip. I was able to just go with my daughter, who is 16 right now. So if you have the opportunity as a father to go on a trip alone with a teenager, that would be very, very much recommended from me. It's just a great opportunity to get them to talk. There's nothing like being in a car by yourself with your teenager or on a plane. That really brings out a lot of topics of conversation that you probably wouldn't otherwise think to bring up when just in the course of a busy day or a busy week, like it often is right around here at Edstone. In any event, on today's show, we're going to be looking at quite a few different things, some statistics from the program that played here in the UK over the weekend, the one in which we offered the Holy Roman Empire booklet. So coming up in a later segment, we'll update you on those figures. Also, we'll talk more about the banking crisis in Europe. We spent a fair bit of time on this last week, and again, more stories keep rolling in. So at least there are some news outlets that are warning of what's coming, of what's happening in Germany, in Europe, and how that it's going to impact the entire world. I'd also like to dig into Herbert Armstrong's autobiography a little bit more. We got into this on Friday, if you listened to that show, and just talked about some of those early lessons in the life of Herbert Armstrong, a young Herbert Armstrong when he was a teenager, when he was a young man, and learning some important lessons that would benefit him greatly later on in life. Well, I didn't get the exact count of how many days we have left until the U.S. elections, 30-something, I guess, a little over a month away. And, of course, you're going to be getting the countdown from so many news outlets from this point forward. And you look at what's been happening over the weekend with the New York Times now really going after Donald Trump, doing everything that it can to bring down the Trump train, so to speak, talking about his, I guess it was some taxes from 1995 or something like that, to where it shows that because of losses or huge losses from the year before, those were able to roll over for many years after it, which allowed for him not to have to pay taxes. And of course, many liberal agencies are hopping right on this to say that he's not like the common man in America, and you know, he's like any other rich individual that does everything that he can to avoid paying taxes. And then others then have jumped on and defended him and talked about how hypocritical the New York Times is for calling out Mr. Trump on something that the New York Times itself does. And so as we draw closer to these elections, whether it's Mr. Trump's taxes or Hillary Clinton's emails, it's, I'm sure, going to get a lot uglier. I noticed in the New York Times just today that the headline was Donald Trump's business decisions in the 1980s nearly led him to ruin. So they're going to do everything they can to chip away at this this self-proclaimed reputation that he's been putting out there all through the campaign cycle, that he's a very successful businessman and so on. And the New York Times is invested in this to bring him down and to prop up any and every liberal that it can. Victor Davis Hanson, by the way, had a piece last week talking about the next president unbound, and he opened his article by saying how that on the one side, you know, you have Donald Trump supporters seeing Hillary Clinton as a great danger to the United States, and how that if we can't get Trump in there, well, then we lose hope of any hope of ever getting this back to a smaller government or constitutional protections, as he brings out, personal liberty. And then, of course, there's those on the side of Hillary Clinton that are out there saying if Trump were to win, I mean, that would just be the end of America as we know it. It would be like bringing in another dictator, like Adolf Hitler. And Hanson goes on to talk about what some of the reasoning might be, or the reasons for this kind of hysterical outpouring from either side. But then he brings up really what the underlying cause of all this concern really and truly is. And as he often does, he hits the nail right on the head, saying that the model of the imperial Obama presidency is the greater fear. I mean, when you look at what's happened over the last 7.5 years, the supporters of Trump and Hillary Clinton have good reason to be concerned about, well, what happens if the other side wins? Look at what President Obama has been able to get away with. Hanson says, over the last 8 years, Obama has transformed the powers of the presidency in a way not seen in decades. A way not seen in decades. Think about the article we had in the May-June Trumpet. Andrew Miller wrote that. The rise of the super president. Really, we haven't seen this in decades, Hanson says. Andrew Miller said that no president since World War II has openly justified executive overreach by saying that it was necessary to circumvent legislatures because they refused to do what he wanted. I mean, these are things that just haven't been done, or that haven't been done in decades or since World War II. Last week, Jay Solomon, I mentioned the book that he wrote on a program not too long ago about the Iran nuke deal, and he's been right on top of this story. He just keeps revealing more about that nefarious deal from earlier this year. Jay Solomon wrote at the Wall Street Journal, the Obama administration agreed to back the lifting of United Nations sanctions on two Iranian state banks blacklisted for financing Iran's ballistic missile program on the very same day in January that Tehran released four American citizens from prison, according to U.S. officials and congressional staff briefed on the deliberations. So we just keep finding out more and more and more. The administration just does it. Sanctions on these two banks blacklisted because of their support for or their financing Iran's ballistic missile program. And the Obama administration just lifts those sanctions, and everyone carries on business as usual. Davis Hanson here, he says Congress talks grandly of comprehensive immigration reform, but Mr. Obama, as he promised with his pen and phone, bypassed the House and Senate to virtually open the border with Mexico. He just went right around the House, right around the Senate. No problem. President Obama largely ceased deportations of undocumented immigrants. He issued executive order amnesties, and he allowed entire cities to be exempt from federal immigration law. The president said nothing about this extraordinary overreach, or rather the press said nothing about this extraordinary overreach of presidential power, mainly because these largely illegal means were used to achieve the progressive ends favored by many journalists. Many journalists favor this, and so they don't say anything. There's a few liberals. Jonathan Turley, the scholar that's a self-proclaimed liberal, he's come out and sounded the alarm about the powers that this administration, that this president has grabbed for himself. But very few are willing to do that. Very few from the left side. Because they favor these policies. The end justifies the means, they think. Well, you go back to, this actually is referred to in Andrew Miller's piece from the May-June trumpet, this comment by President Obama from back in January of 2014. So this is almost 2 years ago, the infamous statement about the pen and the phone. This is clip 8.
We are not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure that we're providing Americans the kind of help that they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone. And I can use that pen to sign executive orders and take executive actions and administrative actions that move the ball forward in helping to make sure our kids are getting the best education possible, making sure that our businesses are getting the kind of support and help they need to grow and advance, to make sure that people are getting the skills that they need to get those jobs that our businesses are creating.
All sounds great. The last part, we're just trying to help people, of course. I mean, it's all about giving people opportunity and skills and jobs and so on. But you go back to the start of that statement, we're not going to wait for legislation? So Congress has no say in it? We're just going to move around Congress and do it ourselves? Well, not too many sounded the alarm over that shocking statement. Here he was admitting openly that if Congress isn't going to do its job, or if it's not going to do it fast enough, then I'll go ahead and act myself. And he's been doing that. You have to give him credit. He's following through on that statement. Victor Davis Hanson here. He just rattles off the history, the recent history, this presidency, saying the Senate used to ratify treaties. In the past, a president could not unilaterally approve the Treaty of Versailles, enroll the United States in the League of Nations, fight in Vietnam or Iraq without congressional authorization, change existing laws by non-enforcement, or rewrite bankruptcy laws. Not now. Not now. Obama set a precedent that he did not need Senate ratification to mark a landmark treaty with Iran on nuclear enrichment. He picked and chose which elements of the Affordable Care Act would be enforced, predicated on his 2012 re-election efforts. It was all politicized. He was picking and choosing, knowing just what the Americans would need in order to vote for him again. It says, rebuffed by Congress, Obama is now slowly shutting down the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center by insidiously having inmates sent to other countries. We've talked about that on this program multiple times. Congress won't do it, so he's slowly but surely shutting it down himself. Just sending these terrorists off to other countries where they're allowed to roam freely. Or in the case of about, what, a third or half of them? To rejoin their terrorist friends on the battlefield. That's what's happening. It says here, respective opponents of both Trump and Clinton should be worried. That's what Victor Davis Hanson says. They should be worried. Given what this super president is doing, this uber president, they should be concerned. They should be worried. Either winner could follow the precedent of allowing any sanctuary city or state in the United States to be immune from any federal law found displeasing, from the Liberal Endangered Species Act and federal gun registration laws to conservative abortion restrictions. Could anyone complain if Trump's Secretary of State were investigated by Trump's Attorney General or for lying about a private email server in the manner of Clinton being investigated by Loretta Lynch? Would anyone object should a President Trump agree to a treaty with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the same way Obama overrode Congress with the Iran deal? Victor Davis Hanson says, if a President Clinton decides to strike North Korea, would she really need congressional authorization considering Obama's unauthorized Libyan bombing mission? What would Americans say if President Trump's IRS, mirror imaging Lois Lerner, hounded the progressive nonprofit organizations of George Soros? Partisans are shocked that the press does not go after Trump's various inconsistencies and fibs about his supposed initial opposition to the Iraq War, or press him on the details of Trump University. Conservatives counter that Clinton has never had to come clean about the likely illegal pay-for-play influence peddling of the Clinton Foundation, or her serial lies about her private email server. It says, but why, if elected, should either worry much about media scrutiny? Why should either side have to worry? President Obama says, establish the precedent that a president should be given a pass on lying to the American people. Did Americans, as Obama repeatedly promised, really get to keep their doctors and health plans while enjoying lower premiums and deductibles as the country saved billions through his Affordable Care Act? More recently, did Obama mean to tell a lie when he swore that he sent cash to the Iranians only because he could not wire them the money, when in truth the administration had wired money to Iran in the past? Was cash to Iran really not a ransom for American hostages, as the president asserted? Did Obama really, as he insisted, never email Clinton at her private unsecured server? Can the next president, like Obama, double the national debt and claim to be a deficit hawk? And it just goes on and on and on. Well, those on the side of Trump, those on the side of Clinton, they have good reason to worry. Hansen concludes here, one reason Americans are scared about the next president, is that they should be. They should be. In 2017, a President Trump or President Clinton will be able to do almost anything he or she wishes without much oversight, thanks to the precedent of Mr. Obama's overreach, abetted by a lapdog press that forgot that the ends never justify the means. The next President Unbound, or as Andrew Miller put it in the May-June trumpet, the rise of the super president back in 2014. This was not long after the pen and the phone comment by President Obama. This law professor, Jonathan Turley, I mentioned him a moment ago, this political liberal, he talked about the separation of powers and how important it was for the functioning U.S. government to maintain that. Otherwise, everything begins to break down. Turley wrote in an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times, this is from March of 2014, the system of separation of powers was not created to protect the authority of each branch for its own sake. Rather, it's the primary protection of individual rights because it prevents the concentration of power in any one branch. See, those powers are separated in the three different branches to protect your individual rights if you're an American. Turley said, in this sense, Mr. Obama is not simply posing a danger to the constitutional system. He has become the very danger that separation of powers was designed to avoid. There are powers in the U.S. government. They're there. They were designed to prevent what we see happening. And yet it's happening. The whole system's beginning to break down. Turley said this, the United States is at a constitutional tipping point. The rise of an Uber presidency, unchecked by the other two branches. And that's what we're seeing. An Uber presidency that's not held in check by the other two branches. And this comes from a law professor who is a committed liberal. sounding the alarm. On the other side of the aisle, you have the late Antonin Scalia. This takes us back a little bit further to October of 2011. And I've got a few clips here. There, a couple of them are a little longer. But this is how Mr. Scalia set up his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he was talking here at the outset about just the general ignorance among law students right in the United States. The general ignorance that's there with respect to the U.S. government. This is Antonin Scalia, October 5th, 2011, clip 9.
I speak to law students from the best law schools, people presumably especially interested in the law, and I ask them, how many of you have read the Federalist Papers? And a lot of hands will go, no, not just number 48 and the big ones. How many of you have read the Federalist Papers, cover to cover? Never more than about 5%. And that is very sad. I mean, especially if you're interested in the Constitution. Here's a document that says what the framers of it thought they were doing. It's such a profound exposition of political science that it is studied in political science courses in Europe. And yet we have raised a generation of Americans who are not familiar with it.
That's Antonin Scalia from 2011 before the Senate Judiciary Committee, talking about the law students that he speaks with, having, well, not read through these founding documents, or the paper, in the case of the Federalist Papers, the papers that explain what the framers had in mind when they wrote the Constitution. 5%, about 5%, he said. And these are law students from the best law schools. Forget about just the average Joe that's not really into political science, as he said there. Law students at the best law schools. Is it any wonder, as Jonathan Turley warned a couple of years ago, that we're at a tipping point? That we're witnessing the rise of the Uber presidency? That the presidency is no longer checked by the other two branches? Scalia went on to say in the same testimony, notice this is clip 10.
When I speak to these groups, the first point I make, and I think it's even a little more fundamental than the one that Stephen has just put forward, I ask them, what do you think is the reason that America is such a free country? What is it in our Constitution that makes us what we are? And I guarantee you that the response I will get, and you will get this from almost any American, including the woman that he was talking to at the supermarket, the answer would be freedom of speech, freedom of the press, no unreasonable searches and seizures, no quartering of troops in hope, those marvelous provisions of the Bill of Rights. But then I tell them, if you think that a Bill of Rights is what sets us apart, you're crazy. Every banana republic in the world has a Bill of Rights. Every president for life has a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights of the former evil empire, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, was much better than ours. I mean it literally. It was much better. We guarantee freedom of speech and of the press. Big deal. They guaranteed freedom of speech, of the press, of street demonstrations and protests, and anyone who is caught trying to suppress criticism of the government will be called to account. Whoa, that is wonderful stuff. Of course, just words on paper, what our framers would have called a parchment guarantee. And the reason is that the real constitution of the Soviet Union, you think of the word constitution, it doesn't mean a bill, it means structure. Say a person has a sound constitution, has a sound structure. The real constitution of the Soviet Union, which is what our framers debated that whole summer in Philadelphia in 1787. They didn't talk about the Bill of Rights. That was an afterthought, wasn't it? That constitution of the Soviet Union did not prevent the centralization of power in one person or in one party. And when that happens, The game is over. The Bill of Rights is just what our framers would call a parchment guarantee.
When that happens, the game is over, he said there at the end. Now, we talked about how when Justice Scalia died earlier this year, that was a significant change. Of course, we haven't seen his replacement as yet. Supreme Court's now back in session, and of course that's going to be back in the news. Who's going to fill that ninth seat? But here was the one, the true originalist on that court, or at least one of maybe two or three, talking about what it is that makes America such a free country, and the Bill of Rights, as good as those rights are, they're just words on paper if you don't have the separation of powers. They're just words on paper. It's just a parchment guarantee. If your Constitution does not prevent the centralization of power, all you're left with are words. Words on paper that aren't applied, that aren't enforced. This is where it's headed. America under attack. As we've been saying, America under attack. One final clip here that I'll play for you. Again, this is from that 2011 testimony, Justice Scalia's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, clip 11.
So, the real key to the distinctiveness of America is the structure of our government. One part of it, of course, is the independence of the judiciary. But there's a lot more. There are very few countries in the world, for example, that have a bicameral legislature. Oh, England has a House of Lords for the time being, but the House of Lords has no substantial power. They can just make the Commons pass a bill a second time. France has a Senate. It's honorific. Italy has a Senate. It's honorific. Very few countries have two separate bodies in the legislature equally powerful. That's a lot of trouble, as you gentlemen doubtless know, to get the same language through two different bodies elected in a different fashion. Very few countries in the world have a separately elected chief executive. Sometimes I go to Europe to talk about separation of powers, and when I get there, I find that all I'm talking about is independence of the judiciary, because the Europeans don't even try to divide the two political powers, the two political branches, the legislature and the chief executive. In all of the parliamentary countries, the chief executive is the creature of the legislature. There's never any disagreement between them and the prime minister, as there is sometimes between you and the president. When there's a disagreement, they just kick him out. They have a no-confidence vote, a new election, and they get a prime minister who agrees with the legislature. And, the Europeans look at this system and they say, well, it passes one house, it doesn't pass the other house. Sometimes the other house is in the control of a different party. It passes both, and then this president, who has a veto power, vetoes it, and they look at this and they say, it is gridlock. And I hear Americans saying this nowadays, and there's a lot of it going around. They talk about a dysfunctional government because there's disagreement, and the framers would have said, yes, that's exactly the way we set it up. We wanted this to be power, contradicting power, because the main ill that beset us, as Hamilton said in The Federalist, when he talked about a separate Senate, he said, yes, it seems inconvenient, but inasmuch as the main ill that besets us is an excess of legislation, it won't be so bad. This is 1787. He didn't know what an excess of legislation was. So unless Americans can appreciate that and learn to love the separation of powers, which means learning to love the gridlock, which the framers believed would be the main protection of minorities. The main protection. If a bill is about to pass that really comes down hard on some minority, they think it's terribly unfair, it doesn't take much to throw a monkey wrench into this complex system.
So Americans should appreciate that, and they should learn to love the gridlock.
That's Antonin Scalia explaining the very clearly, by the way, the separation of powers written into the U.S. Constitution. Now, that's obviously what he's describing there is not God's government by any means. But it is the best form of government that man has produced to ensure freedom and liberty for all, equality for all, equality of opportunity for all. And we see those pillars, those constitutional pillars, they're now breaking down. They're crumbling to the ground with the Uber presidency and the centralization of power coming into the White House. This is what more voices should be sounding the alarm about. Of course, with Scalia now gone from the scene, you're not going to hear him explaining so clearly, so lucidly what the framers believe. This is exactly the way we set it up. This is why we put in those contradicting powers. Because men are not angels, as it says in the Federalist Papers. Well, and as we know, as God's people, even angels had their trouble, didn't they? A third of them did. Submitting to God's authority and power. But here came these framers back in the late 1700s. Just before God was about to pour out all of these phenomenal blessings upon the people of Manasseh, and God inspired much of that language in the Declaration, in the Constitution, because of what he was about to give to Manasseh. And yet, as inspired as those documents are, we're not, 240 years on? It's really been a short run for the United States. It's all falling apart and breaking down now for the United States. The spirit of lawlessness has set in. America is under attack. Well, it's good to go back and to get some perspective on the way that it was set up from the beginning. We talk so much in this church about the early days of Herbert Armstrong's ministry, or going back further to what Jesus Christ and the apostles actually taught. Go back to the source. Go back to the original source, the source documents. And read what they say. Read what others said about them. And you can find out what they meant. You can find out what they were getting at. And then hold on to those words, as Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5. Prove all things, and then hold on to that which is good. If you let go of that which is good, what are you left with? Well, you might have the words on the parchment, but the country, the nation, the government institutions, it all begins to break down. When we come back, we'll look at a couple of those stories that I mentioned with respect to the oncoming banking crisis in Europe. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this week, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
A year ago, Richard Palmer and I wrote an article for The Trumpet, Look Who Rules Europe, that was based on, I think, a couple of programs that we had put together for the radio show. And in that piece, we quoted from George Friedman. We quote him often, of course. And he was talking in one of his reports about how that Germans really wanted to just be wealthy and rich, that they didn't necessarily want to dominate Europe. But as Friedman brought out in the piece that he wrote on it, in order to secure the wealth that Germans wanted, I mean, they had to dominate Europe. They had to dominate. And this has just been their natural default position, you could say. Well, this, of course, you're aware of the latest with Deutsche Bank. And it's interesting to see what some of these reports are saying, not just about the bank, which is in dire straits right now, but about the German people and the way that they're reacting. This story here, Bloomberg View, it says Deutsche's troubles touch a nationalist nerve. This is from today in Bloomberg. It says the International Monetary Fund warned 3 months ago that Deutsche Bank posed a potential systemic threat to the global financial system. Today, the problems facing Germany's largest lender are fueling a different kind of risk, that of a growing nationalist backlash in Germany. You know, we've talked a lot about what's been happening there in some of those regional elections. But this article here says, again, when you go back to what we wrote a year ago, paraphrasing Friedman, Germans seeking wealth and prosperity, as so many nations do. And now with this crisis here, it's prompting a nationalist response. On Monday, the chairman of the German Parliament's Economics Committee gave an interview to Welt am Sonntag, in which he called the $14 billion fine over Deutsche's mortgage-backed securities business dating back to the financial crisis extortionate, and said that the fine has the characteristics of an economic war. And that's another angle to this development as well. But let me just skip further ahead here and concentrate primarily on the way that the German people are responding to this. Further on, it says, the main target of criticism has been the European financial system Germany helped create. The European Central Bank is blamed for hobbling Deutsche Bank, hurting German savers, and propping up profligate, debt-ridden governments on the Eurozone periphery. It says, in all the protests about outside meddling, there's an element of posturing to the run-up to next year's national elections, with the populist anti-Euro Alternative for Germany party making striking gains in local elections. Germany's mainstream politicians are eager to lay blame elsewhere for Germany's problems and demonstrate their own nationalist credentials to German voters, weary of seeing German interests compromised for EU goals. And so it's saying, you know, there's some things that prompted Britain to leave, Brexit. There's some of those same sentiments in Germany. Now, they're not going to break free, obviously, but there's a lot of restructuring to come. And suffice it to say, I mean, there's a lot of discontent in Germany. Why should we give up our rights, our interests? Or why should they be compromised for EU goals? In other words, why shouldn't we dominate? I mean, look at who we are. Look at the economic powerhouse that we are compared to the others. It says, but the debate goes beyond election politics and interest rates. After the UK's vote to leave the EU, but also the Greek crisis, the refugee crisis, and now bank troubles, Germany is rethinking its stance on European integration. The wider the disparities between Eurozone countries, the more vulnerable the entire single currency project. If Germany's going to shoulder the burden of propping up high-debt Eurozone economies, the thinking goes, then Germany ought to get more of a say in how things are run. And we've said all the way through this, going back to the euro, everything. I mean, it's all the Greek crisis. It's been a setup to give Germany more power. It says here later, and export-oriented Germany has reaped the benefits of a currency that is substantially weaker than the Deutschmark would have been, giving it an enormous trade surplus. So it's benefited from the euro, as this Times, or rather this Bloomberg piece brings out. Well, let me just back up, actually. That was the last statement of this paragraph I wanted to read. But Bloomberg says here, it's an odd turn of events. Germany is pretty much the reason there is a European Union at all. So Germany, you know, is the thinking is now we ought to get more of a say. And then Bloomberg goes on to say, Germany's pretty much the reason there's a European Union at all. The European Coal and Steel Community was formed in 1951 to harness German industrial might to French statecraft. The euro, which Germany accepted as the price for reunification, was fundamentally a political project to further tighten the knot. And export-oriented Germany, I read this bit a moment ago, has reaped the benefits of a currency that is substantially weaker than the Deutschmark would have been, giving it an enormous trade surplus. So Germany, over and again, has just benefited from this, and now they want more. I mean, now why should we sacrifice our agenda or our national interests for the wider European project? Well, that's from Bloomberg View. And Richard Palmer gave me another piece this morning that just shows this is not something, as we said last week, that's limited to Deutsche Bank alone, this banking crisis, as the Telegraph noted this morning. I mean, this is far-reaching, and it's far from over. The Telegraph said 9 years after the initial eruption, that's speaking of the banking crisis going back to 2008, 9 years after the initial eruption, it still rumbles on, with the epicenter now moved from the U.S. to Europe. Only it's not the same crisis. In large measure, it's completely different. So the epicenter's moved from U.S. to Europe. We played the soundbite last week. Mr. Armstrong saying that it was going to be a banking or a financial crisis that would trigger this, that would bring Europe together, the Ten Kings. And here the epicenter is now right in the heart of Europe. The Telegraph says today's mayhem is not so much the result of reckless bankers and asleep-at-the-wheel regulators, but rather of the public policy response to the last crisis itself. That is to say, regulatory overreach and central bank money printing, some of the same problems that we've talked about with respect to the United States. All eyes are naturally focused on the specific problems of Deutsche Bank, but Deutsche is, in truth, no more than the canary in the coal mine. As to Jane Thiem, chief executive of Credit Suisse, observed last week, as an entire sector, European banks are still not really investable. Much of the same disease as afflicts continental banks also applies to British counterparts, including Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays, and even Lloyd's. The Telegraph says all are fast being enveloped by a perfect storm of negatives, and this time around, it's substantially the policymakers and law enforcement who are to blame. And so the problem was not fixed following the crisis of 2008. All the problems are still there. The epicenter is shifting to Europe, but a crisis that's going to be bigger than the last one, It's coming, and again, when it does, remember what Mr. Armstrong said about how dramatically that will impact the prophecies regarding the Ten Kings in Europe. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back with the few minutes that we have left, we'll update you on some stats and also redirect our attention to some of the lessons from those early chapters of Herbert W. Armstrong's autobiography. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Over the weekend, our television program here in the UK, we titled that The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, and we offered the booklet that goes by that same name, Brad McDonald's booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. I think it's the third, maybe the fourth time that we've offered that since that book was printed last year. It brought in 151 requests for the booklet, so a solid program with some good response that came in. This next week, by the way, we've scheduled the repeat that we've used more than any other program on the air over here in the UK, and that is the Mystery of the Ages program on the greatest book since the Bible. That I believe we've played three or four times, and each time it's generated a huge response. So we thought this would be a good time, since it's been I think 4 or 5 months since we last played it, to have that one run again. So you can be thinking about that, and we'll certainly update you on the response numbers to that program next week. Well, in reading Herbert Armstrong's autobiography, it's a huge book, so it'll take me a little bit of time to get through it. But so many of the lessons that that stand out to me from the early chapters on the, I mean, they really are, as I'm going to talk to our young people about here in just a bit with the college and the academy. But so much helpful instruction, so many profound lessons coming from a young man that, at that point in his life, he wasn't even in God's church. He hadn't been converted to God's truth, and yet you can clearly see God's hand in the development of the young Herbert W. Armstrong. I talked last week about the spark of ambition, and how that when Mr. Armstrong got that job in Altoona, just a little ways outside of Des Moines, Iowa, when he was 16 years of age, he had that hotel manager, you'll recall, who came up to him. He was a man of about 45, I guess, and he kept encouraging Mr. Armstrong, telling him that he saw some good traits in him, character-wise, and that he had a good hard work ethic, and that if he kept on the same course, that he'd really make something of his life. And Mr. Armstrong said that exchange, or those several exchanges he had with that hotel manager, it really lit the spark of ambition that made him want to be something, to do something with his life. And then when you get into the second chapter of the autobiography, he opens it by talking about this book he read as an 18-year-old on choosing a vocation, and he went through this thorough survey to find out what it was that he would be good at, what it was he would like, and he got through that study and realized that he should get into the world of advertising. And then that took him to some critical discussions that he had with his Uncle Frank, who was a prominent figure in the advertising industry there in the state of Iowa. And so he sought counsel from his uncle about how he should go about educating himself. And then they had the exchange about modern education or college education today. And his Uncle Frank was just to very simply paraphrase it. His Uncle Frank said, look, you're not going to get the education and the training you need from some college assembly line. Here's what you need to do. And he gave him things that he should be reading and studying, and of course ways that he could begin to accumulate experience on the job, learning on the job. There's a great section there at the outset of chapter 2 about true education, and then you move your way on through that chapter and see again the many lessons he was learning early on in his life, the rules for success. Let me just take you back to this Choosing a Vocation book that he got when he was 18. This is a clip from his old radio broadcast. Mr. Armstrong here describing that book, Choosing a Vocation, and the impact that it had on his life. This is clip one.
I remember that when I was a young fellow of 18 years of age, I found a book. I don't suppose that book's around anywhere now. I haven't really looked myself because I went through it years ago. The title of it, I remember very well, though. It was Choosing a Vocation. I don't remember the author. It took me through a course of self-analysis, analyzing all aptitudes and likes and dislikes and strong points and weaknesses, any possible talents, and also the lack of it, and where you would fit. And then an analysis of various professions, occupations, jobs of all kinds to see where your particular talents and abilities and the things you like to do will fit in, and where you can avoid the things that might handicap you and where you have the best chance of success. So far as choosing a profession or a job is concerned, everyone ought to make some sort of an analysis of that kind. Perhaps you can find a book in the public library.
He recommended that everyone, particularly young men, that they dig into some kind of study similar to that so that they can find out what it is that they should go after and pursue. Mr. Armstrong talked a lot about, over the course of his ministry, he talked often to young people about how that most in the world today are just victims of circumstance. They just drift. They drift along, tossed to and fro. Looking at it spiritually, Ephesians 4 talks about us being tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. And Mr. Armstrong said, look, you've got to choose. You've got to set the goals, the right goal. As he says in his booklet, The Seven Laws of Success. He opens that booklet, by the way, saying, did it ever occur to you that there might be a reason why so many people make a failure of life? Not only men and career women, but wives and mothers too. He says, are you one who is wrestling with the problem of making ends meet? Nearly all of us are. This problem need not mean failure, yet it often leads to it. It's a fact, he says, the vast majority do wind up failures. The vast majority, they wind up as failures because they just drift. They drift along. One more clip I think we have time for here. This is more recently. This is from a TV program that Mr. Armstrong produced back in 1984. And in this one, he talks about the exchange he had with his uncle and how it impacted his approach to education. Clip two.
And so I took up the advertising profession. Now, at that time, there was no school or no college or university anywhere in the United States that had a course in advertising and merchandising that was worth attending. My uncle, my father's younger brother, was the leading advertising man in the state of Iowa, and he was the first president of the state association. And so I naturally went to him for advice. And he told me that if I would procure the books, and if I'd spend my evenings in study, and if I would apply myself, I could get just as good an education, and perhaps better, out of college than I could in. He said, education doesn't necessarily consist of traipsing over the door sill of a college classroom or sitting in an armchair before a college lecturer.
However, I realized, too, that education consisted to some extent with contact with others who have an influence over you and who can teach you. And education consists of study, it consists of thinking, it consists of mixing minds with other people, it consists of travel, it consists of observation and thinking and action. And so I decided that I had the ambition and the desire to work, and I would get my education in that way. Well, I was quite successful.
And he was. He was quite successful. God was preparing him. That information, many of those thoughts he just conveyed there, you can find at the early part of chapter 2 in his autobiography. There's some other lessons that we can take away from that chapter as well, but I'll have to get into that at a later time because we're out of time for today's program. So the rest of these clips and this information we'll have to save for another show. This is Stephen Fleury for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Email the program, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us again today. We'll see you tomorrow.